You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Oh, look, it's Derek and Danny from the American Prestige Media Conglomerate. They're here for once every 2 months. Oh, wow. How are you doing, guys?
Good. Bob, I heard you. I listened to you outside of this podcast. You mentioned us a couple times, but not by name. It's only the American Prestige guys. It's not individuals. We're just a collective.
That's all I can remember.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough.
It's so complicated. To further complicate things, I had a good friend named Derek Davis in high school. So, like, just keeping this whole Davis-Davison thing straight is about as much as I can handle.
I get it.
It's too much.
Yeah, so this is the non-zero American Prestige synergy materializing right before people's eyes. Now, guys, here's what I thought. Like, often in these get-togethers, we express criticisms of U.S. foreign policy. We express dissatisfaction with the state of the world. Today, I thought, since so many people are already dissatisfied with the state of the world, we would give them a little pick-me-up, and I would start by asking you, what part of Trump's foreign policy stands some chance of working out well?
Do you want to start, Derek, or you want me to?
No, go ahead.
Well, I would say, just thinking holistically, is that a lot of the things that Trump is attacking needed to be changed. And none of that was going to happen with the Democratic Party, which is I genuinely think is a shame. I think there could have been a more managed transition. And I think that is that might be the best we can hope for in the next 20 years in a lot of different arenas, managed transitions to a new era, whether you're talking about U.S. regional hegemony in East Asia, whether you're talking about dollar hegemony, whatever it is. In an ideal world, there'd be a type of managed transition. But unfortunately, the Democratic Party has shown itself incapable of rethinking effectively status quo positions that had been going on since the Cold War and the post-Cold War era. So a lot of the things needed to be changed. They weren't working. They were corrupt. Of course, Trump is going to just get rid of them and make things more corrupt by privatizing them. But hopefully this will engender a recognition that this is a new era and that things need to transform. That's basically the best I think we could hope for here.
So, go ahead.
No, just to clarify. So you see Trump as pulling away from aspirations to have hegemony in East Asia, even? It isn't just Europe you see as kind of...
I was just referring to that. That's like one that's obviously going to be a managed transition, right? Like obviously China is going to dominate East Asia. This is something that is inevitable. It's going to happen. And I was worried, and I have argued in print, worried that what's going to happen is China is going to do something mega dramatic, whether it involves Taiwan or not. And the U.S. is just going to cut and run as opposed to preparing for an inevitable situation. So I was just using that as an explanation of the type of thing.
Okay. Derek, cheer us up.
I have two actually, and one, the more realistic of the two is, because he did it in his first term, is that, he's going to talk to people who are deemed untouchable by the U.S. foreign policy establishment, like he did with Kim Jong-un. That didn't get us very far, his interactions with Kim Jong-un in the first term, but, I support talking to people, even the evildoers of the world, as much as possible. So if he is able to reengage with North Korea, that seems like maybe it'll be a bit of a tough lift at this point. But if he's able to talk with the Iranians, there's been some suggestion on both sides that there's openness to negotiation, although Trump has reimposed maximum pressure and the Iranians have responded, belligerently to that, as you might expect. But if they can get past that and whether it's, Russia brokering some kind of, interaction or indirect talks or whatever, that's probably a good thing. Again, maybe it won't lead anywhere, but you never know until you try. The other one, which is probably more unrealistic because, again, we've seen this movie before, is that this is finally going to be the wake-up call for Europe to start taking care of its own defense. We saw during Trump's first term a lot of concern about whether the United States would, let's say, you know, uphold Article 5 of the NATO treaty if a European nation came under attack, or you know, whether he was really committed to this idea that the United States should be Europe's security blanket. He was demanding European nations spend a lot more on defense than they have been. And now we have the very specific example of him trying to get out of Ukraine in, you know, probably the most ham-fisted possible way, sort of abandoning the Ukrainians to Russia, which, you know, I want to separate that piece of it out because I don't agree with how he's approached that process. But I do hope that, again, this is another knock on the head for European countries that they need to stop relying on the United States and start defending themselves. This would help the United States long-term disengage from Europe. If you're interested in restraint in U.S. foreign policy, this is the easiest piece of that. It's easier than Asia. It's easier than, you know, certainly easier than the Western Hemisphere, which is going to be a, you know, the United States is never going to leave. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Europe is the easiest one to get away from. All it requires is that, you know, Germany, France, et cetera, start paying for their own national defense. And so, you know, I hope long term that that is something that that will come to pass. You know, again, I'm not optimistic about that because we went through this in the first term. And then, you know, European nations were anxious and sort of white knuckling things at that point. And then Joe Biden got elected and it was like, oh, that's over. We don't have to worry about that now. We can go back to, you know, relying on the United States. And, you know, maybe the second time will be the charm. I don't know. I think this is a continent full of governments that are leaders that that are want to be deluded into thinking that the United States is always going to be there for them so they don't have to worry about this stuff. So I don't know. I'm not as optimistic about that.
And Bob, can I just add something very quickly? I do think I've long been a critic of the United States sending weapons to Ukraine because I'm a critic of the U.S. empire and the United States arming the world. But it is totally legitimate for European countries to do something like that. And I think that return to a more regional order would actually be better off, would be better for Europe and would make the United States better off in the long term as well. And it's just something that needs to happen. This era of post-45 and something that was steroidally injected in post-1989 just needs to end. The United States needs to stop intervening abroad. And I just want to, I agree with Derek, this European thing could, in the medium term, turn out to be something rather positive.
Yeah. On Derek's point about talking to untouchables, I do think that tendency is welcome. There have already been reports over the last couple of days that we've had direct talks with Hamas, which other administrations weren't known for. Now, characteristically, of course, what Trump is apparently talking to them about is just returning an American hostage and a couple of American bodies or something. I don't know to what extent there's a larger vision at work.
That reporting has also suggested that they're having discussions about bigger picture stuff, like moving to the second phase of the ceasefire agreement. I saw something today, actually, before we recorded, was based on from Reuters, based on a couple of Egyptian sources who said they had made some progress on, you know, kind of getting to the second phase of the ceasefire, the agreement, which is the open-ended ceasefire and eventual Israeli withdrawal from Gaza. So who knows? I mean, who knows if anything will come with that? But
I don't think they're just talking
about the hostages. That's the piece that they've acknowledged publicly. But it sounds like there's more going on than that.
I hope you're right. It's hard to say because, of course, Israel is saying actually we're tearing up the deal we made, which was going to involve a second phase that in turn involved more Israeli withdrawal because we don't want to withdraw. And so we're just going to call the next phase an extension of this one, and we're not going to do some of the things we said we would do. And Trump certainly hasn't said out loud that he has any issues with that. Quite the contrary. Here's a social media post from, I think, yesterday. To the people of Gaza, a beautiful future awaits, but not if you hold hostages. If you do, you are dead. Now, saying that to the people of Gaza is kind of the way a war criminal talks, obviously, but also just note that, as he said before, you know, we've got this deal about the staged release of hostages, And as he's done before, he just suddenly acts as if he wants them all released right away. It's very hard to say. And of course, there is on the pessimistic side his fairly consistent compliance with what people like Netanyahu want him to do. And that's one thing that worries me about Iran as well, even though, yes, he's willing in principle to talk to directly to people that we don't often talk to directly. So it's hard to say. I mean, I have no idea. You know, I thought his kind of deranged ethnic cleansing plan for Gaza he had let go of after getting feedback from Egypt and Saudi Arabia. But he's, you know, been making noises about that again lately.
Yeah, he's still sticking to that. I mean, there was the Arab League. There was an Arab League summit on Tuesday where they proposed an alternative. And it's amazing. I mean, it really kind of a minor miracle that the Arab League was able to agree on something. But collectively, they drafted a proposal to keep everybody in Gaza, to do the reconstruction, turn over government to, you know, an interim authority, and then eventually the Palestinian Authority coming in. You know, plans for creating some like a pan-Arab policing force, basically, to do security. There's a lot of holes in it still. I mean, you don't know what's going to happen to Hamas. And obviously, you know, that would dictate a lot of how the Israelis would feel about this, or how the U.S. would feel about it. There's still a lot of, you know, details to be worked out. But it seemed like a legitimate proposal. And the White House said, no, we're still going to do the ethnic cleansing because it's inhumane to make people live in Gaza while it's being reconstructed because of all the debris and the ordnance. And, you know, to say your plan is inhumane, so I'm going to do ethnic cleansing is just so bizarre. Well,
not only that, like,
what
but
can
in,
you even say
in this post
point?
I just quoted, he says he's going to kill them all.
But he's upgrading the genocide. Yeah.
He's willing to kill them all, but he will not let them live around unexploded ordnance because that would be dangerous for them.
Right. Exactly.
So, yeah, you just don't know what to think. Apparently, one of the big sticking points with the Arab plan from the point of view of Netanyahu and hence Trump, I guess, is that it doesn't involve the immediate disarming of Hamas or any clearly envisioned disarming of Hamas. I heard one of the people who involved in it, somebody from Egypt, talking about it, and they said that can happen when there's a two-state solution clearly in view, which, of course, is a ways from now.
It'll never happen, yeah.
Well, yeah, but certainly not this year.
Oh, and, Bob, I think we could say it's not going to happen at this point, right?
I said that when I came back from Israel in like 2011 or something,
and spent
a week or two in the West Bank, and I came back telling everybody there's never going to be a two-state solution. You don't have to convince me. I mean, it's not quite. There's like maybe a 1% chance, but I've been saying that for a long time. I don't know what's going to happen, but I do know one thing. There's no way to disarm Hamas without killing a whole bunch more civilians. And I don't think Israel really minds that thought. You know, kill some, ethnically cleanse the rest would be fine with Bibi. But I hope they find another way.
One can always hope. Doesn't seem likely, but yeah.
A couple of weeks ago, I sat on a podcast doing kind of the same exercise. How could things work out well for Trump's foreign policy, or where could they work out well? I said, you can imagine a world where as crazy and kind of unhinged as he sounds, you know, in any given arena, whether it's Zelensky in the Oval Office or anywhere else, you can imagine a world where a year or two from now, he says, all of my talk about Gaza on the Riviera galvanized the Arabs, and they came up with a plan and they did it. And all my kind of, you know, withdrawing support from Zelensky galvanized the Europeans and they swung into action. I think the second is much more likely, for, you know, reasons I guess I've already said, and that is, you know, kind of on its way to happening. I mean, who knows whether the momentum will last. But right now, the Europeans are talking the talk and committing on paper certain amounts of funding. I do think it would be a mistake to try to turn the European Union into a vehicle for a serious military alliance. I think the smarter thing would be for just Germany, England, and France to say, okay, for now it's us, and then other states can join. And develop rules that would make sense for a military alliance. You can't let any little nation veto everything, for example.
The old European defense community. This is from the early 60s when the French tried to basically assert themselves within the Western alliance. It's an old idea going back a long time. So there's actually institutional models for it that have been fairly worked out about how to do this non-NATO military alliance effectively. I mean, back then they weren't so stoked about Germany, but I think that has changed. And so it's actually not the most difficult thing to do. People have thought through this and have been thinking about it for decades.
Yeah. It's been a while since the Oval Office thing, but it made such a big splash. Did you guys have any takes on that?
Oh yeah, we did a special. That was a good special. I mean, I just think Zelensky fucked up. Basically taking Trump as a given, that you know who he is and he's not going to change when you're dealing with him, and he is the buck stops here in terms of funding Ukraine. I think Zelensky understandably is under enormous stress. Is probably exhausted after years of this. And I think he was annoyed at J.D. Vance, and he didn't play his cards right diplomatically.
How could you not be annoyed at J.D.
Agreed.
Vance? Like every minute that you're in his presence is like, I would be struggling not to throw up, basically.
Yeah, but yeah, he fucked up. Yeah.
Here's, I have a take that I haven't seen out there a lot about one reason Vance was so irritating, beyond irritating to him. There was right before, as the blow up was happening, Vance did something that actually, I'm sure Vance didn't understand. It was very threatening to Zelensky. So the way it unfolded was, you know, first of all, Vance, I mean, look, Zelensky had been pushing the envelope. If you watch the whole thing, he was very insistent on getting his talking points. This is one
and
of the
for
perils
years,
of having,
right? Yeah. For years, he's been criticized.
Right.
He's who he is. Yeah.
But this is a peril of having this extended press thing before they have their talks and decide what's coming out of the meeting for sure, right? That's not the way other presidents have done it. They if they meet the press, they meet them afterwards. So anyway, but, you know, Trump kind of asked for it. And Trump, by Trump's standards, was pretty tolerant because Zelensky kept at it. It went on for a long time. And then Vance starts getting a little annoyed and launches into this anti-Biden tirade about how, you know, Biden could have headed off the war with diplomacy, which I think there's a real chance of as a matter of fact. But I think what people don't realize is that is deeply threatening to Zelensky because he and Biden were working fist in glove. You know, they were on the same page. You know, we ran a piece in the Non-Zero newsletter. It was actually our first ever piece by an outside contributor, something we're experimenting with. But it was a few weeks ago. By this journalist, Leonid Rogozin, who's based in the Baltics. And it's called How Biden Helped Bring War to Ukraine. And one thing he does is he traces Zelensky's transition from peace candidate, which he was when he became president, very diplomatically engaged, to a candidate who is increasingly hawkish and talking about joining NATO and other things that Putin may have found threatening. And the point Leonid makes is that there's very much a parallel. If you look at kind of the transition point for Zelensky, it pretty much coincides with Biden entering office and saying the kinds of things that Biden would say and Trump wouldn't, like Ukraine must join NATO and stuff. And so, you know, there's no way of knowing for sure whether Leonid is right that kind of Biden was the dependent variable more than Zelensky was. You know, how exactly the causality works. But the fact is that if the narrative catches on that diplomacy before the war could have prevented the death of hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, that's very bad for Zelensky. And that's when he started revving up the stuff about he did his recap. And then at the end said, so what is this diplomacy you speak about, JD? And I think also the subtext was he, you know, obviously theme with him is you can't trust Putin. We need more than words on paper. We need troops on the ground after peace and so on. So it was consistent with that as well. But this is my highly original take.
I mean, he's not wrong in the sense that if you do a piece that doesn't have any kind of, and I'm not saying you know, Ukraine and NATO are going that far, but it doesn't have any kind of break on what Russia could do next. It's, you know, 50-50, basically, whether that will actually mark an end to the war or if the Russians are just going to take, you know, 6 months to rebuild their military, reconstitute it, and then go right back in.
Right. This is the problem. It was never going to get that. This is the problem with the war from the beginning. They were never going to get that. And this is what I've been criticizing. I think I wrote it in February 24th. Like, Ukraine was never going to get what it needed to actually put a stop to Putin. It was just never going to happen. Partially because we have elections in this country, and it was not good. The Americans are not going to be in support of war. They never are in the history of this country. They don't have years long support for a war. So it was doomed from the beginning. And this is why so much of the foreign policy establishment has so much to answer for. They have literal deaths on their hands. A totally ahistorical, totally ignorant. This was never, and it's not going to go Ukraine's way. It just never was going to, with even a basic understanding of the history of U.S. foreign policy. It's very frustrating that the blob just keeps on getting shit wrong and people die for it. And then you're called a moral cretin if you point that out.
And again, this is something that Europe, the Europeans had spent the last, just the last 8 years taking seriously the notion that they need to be able to stand on their own 2 feet. They could do this without the U.S. They could say, look, we're going to put, you know, whatever kind of, Ukraine. You know, not peacekeeping, but we're going to backstop Ukraine. We're going to put a force, a tripwire force in Ukraine to you know, deter the Russians from taking any more action, and we'll freeze things on whatever lines they're at now or whatever is negotiated, and that'll be it. But even now, as you've got like Keir Starmer and Emmanuel Macron talking about, you know, we'll put a European force in Ukraine and we're going to put this together and it's all going to be fine. But we still need the United States to provide air support and, you know, air defense and, you know, all
happen.
This other logistical aid, because they can't do anything on their own. And it's like, it's mind boggling. Like, have you guys not been paying attention to this man for the last few months? He is not going to help you in any way to do this. You have got to figure out how to do it on your own. And it's just, it's frustrating in a sense to watch these people, you know, sort of tread water like this and never really seem to understand the message that's coming out of Washington.
Yeah. I agree with you, first of all. You can't expect, I'm not sure if this is exactly what you're saying, I think you can't expect the Ukrainians to feel secure if there are not some foreign troops on the ground. I mean,
it's got to be something, leave aside, right? Yeah, it's got to be something.
Leave aside whether Russia would invade, wouldn't. The fact is, it's not a realistic expectation about Ukrainian psychology for them to feel secure with anything less. And that's going to be a bitter pill for Russia to swallow. And so we'll see how this goes. The truth is, it's easier for Russia to swallow to the extent that there aren't explicit American backstops, to the extent that this doesn't resemble NATO.
And there were never going to be, my point is, there were never going to be those explicit American backstops. If you know anything about the history of U.S. foreign policy, that was never going to happen. It was not going to happen in 2022 or 2023. Literally, if you say what these people were saying, they just wanted to have a war of attrition in Russia. That's what they wanted. They were not going to actually risk anything American. So
you don't think Biden would have been happy to say, sure, we'll do X, Y, and Z so long?
It doesn't matter, because 2 years later, it would have changed. It doesn't matter. Right.
That's a problem with American foreign policy generally.
Then you need to know the history of American foreign policy. So it was never going to happen, regardless of what any Democratic administration said. So it was doomed from the beginning. And this is why they needed to do serious negotiations in 2022, 2023. And all of these Americans who are claiming that Putin is going to invade Poland are going to wind up selling out Ukraine, and they're responsible for tons of death.
Yeah, no, look, I certainly believe that a more enlightened U.S. foreign policy, going back decades especially, could have prevented this whole thing probably, which isn't to say, you know, Putin's the one who violated international law, invaded, and so on. And so he's the one legally to blame. But I do believe this didn't have to happen. And in fact, if you imagine a world in which the Europeans all along after the Cold War were responsible for European security, and they were making the big decisions, it might well not have happened, because they didn't want to expand NATO, which, whatever people think, is definitely one of the things Putin found threatening. He mentioned NATO 40 times in his speech right before the invasion. And the reason I counted is because people like Julia Yaffe literally said he barely mentioned NATO. And it, you know, it's clear that, well, there were a lot of things going on. And yes, it had to do with history and with cultural and linguistic continuity across the border, and maybe even with Putin thinking about his legacy. But I definitely think war would have been less likely if Clinton hadn't started expanding NATO and Bush hadn't taken another big step in that direction. And the Europeans were begging Bush not to.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
You can't trust this country. And no one should trust this country. I mean, that's
there's a history. I mean, there's empirical evidence that you cannot trust.
It's not even clear. It's not even a question. You know, it's so absurd. No, I mean, I just hate how all this foreign policy analysis acts like the country was created yesterday. It's foolish and ignorant and leads to bad policy.
I know this is well-trodden ground, but it hasn't been trodden for a year or two because that's when we recapped all this stuff. But it's amazing to go back and read the emails and memos of Bill Burns, who was ambassador to Moscow, U.S. ambassador to Moscow, at the end of the Bush administration, warning these people not to take another step toward, not to pledge Ukrainian membership in NATO, which Bush promptly did. He even says, look, Russia's going to start making mischief in Crimea and eastern Ukraine. He spells it out. So, listen, we're almost at a time when we move into overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of both the Non-Zero and American Prestige media conglomerates. And also, there's this, if you're already in one of those categories, you can enter the other one at a 20% discount. All you have to do is go to the post at either place corresponding to this conversation and use your magical powers to penetrate the paywall there. And there's this magical link that will allow you to penetrate the paywall at the other place. It's like synergy. This is media synergy. See, this is, do you remember when, no, you're not old enough, probably Time Warner. And AOL merged.
Yeah, oh, yes. Yeah, one of the big 90s
that
mergers.
That worked out great. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
That worked out great.
Yeah.
They wanted synergy. They didn't know, it turned out they didn't know anything about synergy.
Yeah, only possible because Clinton synergy. Clinton deregulated synergy. Everything that made those huge 90s mergers possible. Oh, God.
Yeah. AOL and Time Warner. That's still fascinating. How did they think that was going to work?
Oh, man. So anyway, in overtime, I guess I do want to talk somewhat about the Middle East. Oh, this speech on campus directive from Trump that if you criticize Israel, you'll be executed or something. He didn't go quite that far. I also want to talk about China. I mean, we've left that out. I'm kind of worried about that. And it's related to like AI and microchips and stuff. But anyway, do you guys have anything else you want to say before we bring down
subscribe
as always
podcasts.
The only way forward is for people to subscribe to these two shows. I think I just
don't see any other hope. Look, God knows I've tried. I've laid awake at night. What other path is there? And it just the words keep coming into my consciousness. Non-Zero American Prestige, which is more American prestige than there actually is these days. But I digress. Okay, so thanks everybody. We're heading into overtime.